Hey, everybody, it's comedian Trent McFellin, and you're listening to my podcast called The Generators. Every single week, I have a cool guest, and we talk about life, professions, creativity, success, failure, and all sorts of other cool stuff. And every single one of these conversations, I learned a great deal, and I'm pretty sure you're going to learn a great deal, too. So hang on tight, and thanks for listening to The Generators. Oh, yeah, it's happening. It's episode 10 of The Generators. Bam! Look at that, 10 episodes, just like that. Banged them out. The Deca episode, I guess, right? That's what 10 means. And we made it. We're on the other side of it. We figured it out. Insane. I hope you're doing well. I hope you had a great weekend. I'm recording this introduction in Trent's Comedy World headquarters in Calgary, Alberta, on Sunday. And it's another scorching hot day here. It's been insanely hot basically since April. I don't think I've watered the lawn as much as I have this year at any other point in my life. This is absolute insanity. I don't know what our obsession is with green grass. And why we pour so much water on it, and why it must look a certain shade of green. You know, we got to have a dark, lush green. Who started that? Who started that thing? That, oh, your lawn. You got to have a lawn. That's the first thing. That's the goal for people, to have a lawn. And then you spend the rest of your life maintaining this small piece of land. If you're a farmer, I get it. You're growing crops. It's your livelihood. That put food on your table, literally, figuratively. I get that. Okay? But if you're just an average Joe living in the suburbs, what do you care? What do you care? If it's tumbleweeds out there, who, you know? I personally don't care. But you know what? Everyone else is doing it. So the next thing you know, you're watering the lawn, right? Just watching the sprinkler back and forth. Anyone else take complete joy in getting the sprinkler water pressure and positioning nailed right the first time? Anyone else? Or is that just an over 40 thing that you take ridiculous amount of pride in? You know what I mean? Where you set up the sprinkler, you kind of gauge where it should go, you turn the valve for water pressure, and you nail it the first time, and it's perfect. I mean, it's a sweet thing. I'm out there by myself, but I'm out high-fiving myself. I love that. So that's the only joy I get in it. The rest of that, and after that, it's like, okay, here we go. Watching this thing go back and forth. When is it enough, you know? That's right. I just did a rant about watering the lawn for 3.5 minutes. Huh? Don't you feel like your time was well spent? Ah, lordy, lordy. I've been at the Comedy Cave here in Calgary all week, working on some new material. And it's coming along. It's coming along, you know? It's one of those things where you have the ideas, and you don't know if they're going to work until you get them up there on the old stage. And you start messing around with the delivery of them and where you put them and whatnot and figuring out if it works. And some of them are really taking life. Others are frustrating me because I can't unlock them. But I'm confident. I'm just going to stay with it. I know it's in there. I just got to spend time with it. So it'll mean probably spending... I got one more crack at it tonight in front of an audience. And then... there'll be a lot of time spent this week kind of looking at it and seeing what I can fix and change and rearrange. And also you can laugh, right? All this done just so you can sit down and go, that was funny. That's why I do all this. You're welcome. No, I can hear you on the other end. I can hear you on the other end. You're like, Trent, thank you very much. And you know what? I accept it and you're welcome. Next week, a little over a week and a half, I guess, I'm back in Newfoundland, the homeland. Back, going to be in Cornerbrook for a little bit, doing a show in Stephenville. No show in Cornerbrook, but it's a show in Stephenville on August 9th. Then we're going to go into Trinity to hang out for a little bit. Beautiful there. Never been there before, so I want to go there and hang out and relax. And then I'm going to go on to St. John's for a little bit to hang out. And I go back to the West Coast and do the gathering in Burlington with my my friends Sean Majunder and Mark Critch and a bunch of other talented folks. I think Joel Plaskett's going to be there this year. And maybe Matt Wright as well. I think I heard a rumor that he might be there too. So, yeah, super pumped to get out to that. Should be anyone who's ever gone to that thing said it's a great time. So I'm looking forward to that. Stephenville tickets on August 9th are moving now too. So if you want to come check out me doing a full show, an hour and change, you should do that. Bailey Jordan Neal is starting the show off with some amazing music. So you should, if you're in that area, go check it out. I'm already preparing myself for when I go back to Newfoundland, how the steady feed of grease that's going to be pouring through my veins when I get back there. It's something I've been conscious of a bunch of trips home, is thinking about, okay, you're going to smell a smell that smells like home, which is the smell of deep fried deliciousness. It's battered fish. It's French fries that are cooked just the right way. It's hard to get a good fry up here in Alberta. I'm not going to lie to you. I love it up here. It's fantastic. But they got to up their fry game. I mean, it's just not acceptable. I mean, the fries are too pale. They look anemic. I'm like, what is wrong with this thing? Bring it to a hospital. Get this fry looked at. It's not cutting it. You know what I mean? So, but back home, fries, I don't know if it's because they don't change the fat. I don't know what it is, but there's a Christmas to it. They're delicious. And so I go back and I go mad on them when I go home. It's fish and chips. It's French fries. There's gravy. I sometimes put ground beef on top of it. That's a West Coast thing. But I know that's coming. So I've been trying to eat well and take care of myself up here for the last bunch of weeks, especially because I know complete abuse of my body is just around the corner. And I quite literally don't feel any shame in that, you know? So what are you going to do? Also, can someone explain to me why a rental car in Newfoundland is $250,000 for a few days? I don't understand why it's so expensive. I think I looked at renting one for a couple of weeks, and it was like one price was like $1,700. I'm like, am I driving a Tesla with an extension cord the length of the province? Why is it so much money? It's a rental car. Like I don't know. I don't understand it. I don't know. I think I might just get a horse. It might be cheaper to buy a horse and ride that across the province back and forth. That's what I'm doing. I just decided. Thank you for letting me talk out a solution. I just figured it out. I'm getting myself a friggin' Clydesdale, and I'm blown across. Okay, not blown across. We're going to take our time. I don't know if they blow. They don't really get up to a fast pace, I don't think. But we're gonna trot across the province, and you can lean on your horn while you see me going down the highway, on the shoulder of the road, if you will. You know what I mean? You see a black man in a Clydesdale in Newfoundland, you're like, oh, there's McClellan. There he is, on the road again. Okay. All right. Well, I should set up this episode. This number 10 is a big one. I've been really amazed again at how many people have been so generous with their time and who have agreed to be guests on the generators. And this week, I don't know if they get any bigger than Cassie Campbell-Pascal, hockey legend, Canadian hockey legend, Cassie Campbell-Pascal. 2 Olympic gold medals. She's got another medal in there as well. I mean, we're talking world champ. I mean, this is, what has she not done in the game of hockey? I mean, she's it. She did all there is to do in the game of women's hockey. And now she's part of the broadcast team with Hockey Night in Canada, with CBC. And so we get into all that, man. We get into what it was like with that rivalry with the United States. She lets us right into the belly of that thing and lets me know exactly what it was like, which was so awesome to hear. And she talks about some her university days and what that meant to her, which was really cool. And then we talk about the other side of things when she gets into broadcasting and what that world was like. I mean, that's a big switch for an athlete. You know, you've been an athlete your whole life, and then suddenly, bam, you're going to be in front of a camera talking and conducting interviews. That's a totally different skill set. So we get into that too. We did this one via phone. This was my first crack at doing one of these phone-wise. I was freaked out about that because I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to get it right, and I'm not a tech guy. So I was like, is this going to work? And what if I talk to her the whole time and it doesn't record? Then I've just wasted her time. Anyway, there's a whole lot of anxiety with it. But I managed to figure it out. And if she sounds a little loud, that's because I was messing with the volumes, and she's a little louder than me in this one. But, you know, I'm learning this, okay? You know what I mean? Give me a break here. But she was fantastic and was so candid with, in the conversation. So I love this one. This is one of my favorites so far. She was so cool to talk to, and, you get why she's so successful. You get why she's done what she's done because, she's super talented, but a genuine person too, it seems. So yeah. So, I hope you enjoy this one, Cassie Campbell Pascal. And yeah, thanks again for listening to the Generators, man. Appreciating the emails and the feedback I've been getting from people that it's been, people have been really enjoying it. And some comics too have been listening to it, and apparently it's been helping them out and other folks in different walks of life. So I really appreciate the feedback. And yeah, so all right, here it is, Cassie Campbell Pascal. Hope you enjoy it. Bye bye. Shutting down, good Lord, baby got 'em open all over town. Strictly bitch, you don't play around. Cover much ground, got game by the town. Getting paid is a forte. Each and every day to play away. Can't get her out of my mind. I think about the girl all the time. East side to the west side, pushing fat rides, it's no surprise. She got tricks in the stash, stacking up the cash fast when it comes to the gas. By no means average, as always she's got to have it.
I'm good, Trent. How are you?
I'm really good, and I understand that you are creating something amazing right now as we speak. Can you let people know what you're doing right now?
Well, right now it's noon Calgary time, and lunch is required for my 6-year-old daughter. So today we're doing a little Kraft mac and cheese. You know, it's nice. Always a good staple around our house when you got to get something done quick, and it's a lot of fun times. So I enjoy it still myself.
I often think how much mac and cheese did I pound as a child? Like that was just, it was just a staple that every Canadian household was just mac. I think it's what kept kids together. Literally. It was the glue. That
Well, now they have like white cheddar and shells and, you know, the alphabet and like all these things that we missed out on. So I definitely need my mac and cheese from time to time.
Yeah, me too. I remember going off to university. It was basically just a cardboard box. I think one box was just full of mac and cheese. It was just like, I knew I would survive. It was like, okay, I have that, so that if I could do nothing else, but eventually I learned to cook for myself. So I survived at some point.
That's good.
Yeah. Thanks for doing this. So we didn't quite meet, I guess, at the Brian Burke Targets for Kids event that was maybe a month or so ago, I guess.
Yeah. I saw you walk by.
Yeah.
It was like a mirage, you know, you just kind of walked by and you had kind of just gotten your big gig. So,
yes.
You know, you were feeling pretty good about yourself, but no, it was, I knew exactly who you were. And Rob was kind of telling me, Rob Kerr was telling me about you and stuff. So, and I actually had looked and saw that you got your new gig. So congratulations.
Thanks very much. I really appreciate it. Yeah, I'm pretty excited. And I think I was a little full of myself as I walked across that parking lot.
That's all right. Yay, you got your big deal. You know, like you are a big deal.
I wanted a T-shirt with big deal written on it, but I couldn't find it anywhere. I was like, yeah. Can you purchase one of these things? You know, so how did you?
I still think I'm a big deal sometimes too. And then someone calls me Casey, and then I'm like, okay, I'm not that big of a deal anymore, you know?
Yeah, I know
so
what you mean.
It's all good.
Nothing more humbling than having your name butchered, and also nothing more humbling than trying to be funny or clever around children who don't get it. Have you had that moment where you think you're the coolest thing in the world, and your kid's just like, I don't really think so, and you're like, all right, back to square one.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think my kid puts me down to earth every day, all the time, and I am so uncool at this stage in her life. So I just keep trying to fight that good fight of being that cool mom, but more importantly, just trying to be a good one, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's a full-time job right there. How did you, so for folks who don't know, this was it was kind of a skeet shooting event that we went to. I had never shot a gun before in my life till that day. So I was terrified. And I wasn't great. I did 3 out of 15 on the first one. And I think I had 10 on the second one. How did you shoot that day?
Do you know, I this is my third year at the event. You know, Brian Burke's second year, and Curtis Glencross used to kind of run the show previous to that, and I got to go and see Curtis and his wife shoot, and she's amazing. And I hit my first target 3 years ago, and then I never hit another target for the rest of the day. And then the following year, realized I was shooting with my wrong eye open. So once we got that corrected, I got a little bit better. But this year, it was my best shooting. I think I had one round that was 13 of 15, and I was kind of a little bit lights out this year for some reason. You know, practice makes perfect, but I have never shot a gun before, and you know, grew up, my would see guns at my grandparents' house. They were, you know, sitting there in the corner, and thank God never got asked to shoot one. But isn't that first shot just sort of, it's a cool feeling. Like, you relieve a lot of stress in that first shot, you know? Yeah. It's like, man, I could get used to this. But, yeah, it was, it's a good event and a good cause. And Berkey's a, you know, obviously a great friend of ours and my husband's boss. So anytime he comes telling you to go somewhere, you just kind of go, you know?
That's right. Grab this gun, go in the woods. You're like, got it. Not a problem. I'm there.
Yeah. Come shoot guns. Okay. Okay.
I got you.
Brian Burke and guns and I don't know. And last year he gave out knives as prizes. It's kind of a scary event, really, if you think about it.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's out in the middle of the woods, but it's beautiful, that area. I mean, when you're looking over the range and just kind of that valley and the downtown area of Calgary, I was like, this thing was a 10-minute, I don't know, like 15, 20-minute drive from my house. I'm like, how did I not know this existed? Like, I felt kind of in the dark. So, I want to go back and check it out on my own. So, it was a fun day for sure. And Brian does much stuff. You know, I think there's this perception of him, I think, you know, in the media and people who don't know him as this gruff, rough character. And he's unique, no doubt about that. But I think he's such a giving person. It's like he's involved in, I think he says yes to pretty much everything people ask him to do.
Yeah, you know what? He is a real special person. And, you know, we know him on a different level, of course. And I've known him for a long, long time. And so, too, as my husband. And, you know, I've babysat his daughters. And, you know, I know his other children from his first marriage. And so we see him in a different light. And so sometimes we laugh at him a little bit when he gets a little funny and he gets his little, I don't know, persona, if you will. He's just he's a terrific human being. He's so loyal. He's just really good to people. And, you know, if he pulls you in on his team, you're going to be part of his team forever. And, you know, he's just a real special guy. And he's done a lot for women's hockey too. He's really helped me. You know, he came on as a governor of the Canadian Women's Hockey League, and, you know, I asked him if he could do that, and I asked him to always help us, and he never says no. So I'm in debt to him for a long time. And, you know, my husband being the assistant general manager of the Calgary Flames, and Brian's his boss, you know, that was his first NHL gig, and so we owe a lot to Brian Burke for our family success, and we're pretty lucky to call him a friend, that's for sure.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I've met him a couple times, and he's always been more than generous and such an intelligent guy. And he's a fascinating guy to talk to and spend time with. But this is my last little complaint and soapbox thing about that event. It's like, so I got to that last round, you know, whatever you call it, the crazy madness, everyone shoot this thing in the air at the same time part, you know?
Yeah.
And I get like valued in between Reger on my left and Kerr on my right, which is basically like two experienced hunters who literally could shoot with their eyes closed. Reger misses, I miss, Kerr says he hit it, but I got to be honest with you, Cassie, like, I don't think it happened, but I'm like, you know what, Kerr's kind of co-organizing the event. I'm like, what am I going to do? There's no protest form to fill out. I'm like, I'm just kind of stuck in the, you know what I mean? And I'm like, did he hit it? I don't know. Like, I didn't see him hit it.
Yeah.
You know what
He's
I mean?
He's a liar. You do know that, right? Like, he lies all the time,
yeah.
That Rob Kerr.
Yeah.
For someone who's such a great guy, like, I could see it. I wasn't even there at that part, and I would believe to this day that he missed.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's just the type of guy he is, you know?
Like, everyone.
And I'm saying this with total sarcasm, as you know.
I know. Rob Kerr is one of the nicest people you'll ever meet, and the reason that we're actually talking now because he was kind enough to reach out on my behalf. But it was one of those things where everyone kind of gave that look of, like, really? And then just kind of accepted it, and we moved on, and I was out. That's all I knew. It's like, I don't shoot anymore.
And he
today.
Had his dog there with him, and, you know, he has the gear on, the boots and stuff. Like, you just don't mess with someone who looks like that and is carrying a gun. So good on you for just carrying on. You know, just carry on.
Exactly.
And let's just do it again, you know?
You pick another hill to die on, as they say. You know what I mean? I'm like, I had a corporate gig that night. I got to get to it. I can't say I was shot by Rob Kerr in the woods. Like, that's not how I can't end the day like that. So I just drove home but it was a fun day and I learned a lot. I like that event too, because you actually do get to kind of mingle a bit, right? Unlike golf tournaments where you kind of just stuck with your foursome kind of thing. Like, you got to mingle with other people while you weren't shooting and stuff. So I really had a fun day with it. I really enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah. Highly recommend it.
No doubt about it. All right. So let's get into it. I was doing a little bit of research, and you went to the University of Guelph. Did you go to Guelph?
I sure did. I am a Griffin through and through. Did you go there?
No, I didn't go there. Oh. I went to Memorial University in Newfoundland, but I put a lot of emphasis and on university, all my time in university, like kind of living on my own for the first time and playing. I played soccer in university, so I really look back on those times fondly. Like, that's a real special time for me. And I saw a clip actually where you were talking about your former teammates. You had a reunion and everyone kind of got together again. And that, isn't that the amazing thing about like university athletics? It's like, you know, you have these bonds that go on for the rest of your life. Like, some of my best friends were people that I met in university or played with at that time. And like, there's no value to put on that, you know?
Yeah. My dad actually went to Memorial University. So I've been there and checked it out. And
nice.
Great school, and not as good as the University of Guelph, of course.
All right.
But
you know what? We're done. We're done.
I know.
Wrap
exactly.
This thing up. It's over.
Shut this down. Shut this down. But you know what? It was true. Like, there were some of us. Oh, the mac and cheese is ready. There's
done
my timer.
Deal. No worries.
There, you know, we hadn't seen each other, some of us, in like 20 years, you know, and all of a sudden we're there. And I think every player except for three were able to show up. And, you know, you kind of look at each other and you're like, man, we're all old now. But it was so much fun. And we've been able to win a championship. We, you know, we didn't have CIS back then or national championships. It was provincial. So we ended up winning in Ontario. And we won with a group of people that, you know, I was the only one that made the national team. But we had so many great players and great leaders. And, you know, we beat U of T, who had like 8 national team players. So Wow. The funny thing is, though, is when you get back together with those girls, you don't even talk about that stuff. You talk about like the funny things we used to do and the rookie initiations and all these. And we just laughed and laughed. And, you know, there's always one girl that remembers everything. You know, she remembers every detail about everything. And she just kind of like holds court and, you know, makes it so much fun for the rest of us. And, you know, we just really had a good night. And I was there for the World Cup and doing some stuff. And I, you know, the people I was working with, I just said, hey, I need this one night off. Can you give me this one night off? And as soon as I told them, they were like, yeah, no problem. And it was a blast. And I was just so fortunate to be able to be there.
Yeah, it's such a great thing. And I still one of the guys that I played with. And it's the same thing. We don't talk about the games at all or the battles that you had. You talk about those, you know, those times on the bus or in the hotels and stuff. And it's that real team bonding stuff that I think is what you hold so dear at the end of the day. But one of the things, too, I realized during my university years was like you had to learn time management. Like, I'm trying to figure out, I got to get to class. I got to get these papers done. I got to get to training. I got morning practice. I got to practice after class. Like, it was a real, I remember that first time of feeling stressed for the first time in my life. You know, like high school was, you kind of coasted through, you had exam pressure or whatever, but university was the first time where I felt like, man, I got a lot of balls in the air here that I'm trying to keep going. You know, like that's why I think it was so formative for me too.
Well, and I think the fact that you played sports, so you knew that if you didn't do well in school, sport was going to stop, right? Like, that's just kind of the way it worked. And, you know, I got a lot of my silliness out in high school. I was not, I went to one of the roughest high schools outside of Toronto in Brampton, Ontario. And, you know, I could have easily gone off the wrong track. And, you know, my friends and I, we just had a lot of fun. And the rules in my family were you did well in school and you did well in your extracurricular activities. You could pretty much do what you want. And so I made sure that happened, and then I kind of did what I want and had a lot of fun. And so when I got to university, I mean, I still had fun, but I played for 2 hockey teams, plus I was, you know, trying to make the national team, and plus I was in school, and, you know what this is all about. So, you know, I just got a lot more focused and when I went to university, and I always had to work at my studies. You know, it was just something that, you know, I just had to work at it. It wasn't like I was a 90 student, you know, just by fluke or whatever. I always had to work on it. And I never actually made it to the 90s in university. But anyway, that's another story. And, but, you know, I always did well enough so I could play sport, you know, and that was sort of a key thing in our family and a key thing for my career. And I think athletes tend to be the best time management because often, you know, your academics, if it suffers, your coach is like, okay, take a seat. Don't come to practice until you get your grades up or whatever. So it's a real good time management thing that I think we learned from athletics.
Yeah, for sure. I totally agree with that. I remember one of our road trips, our coach actually had to supervise an exam for one of our players because he was going to be away on the road. So it's like he had to sit basically in his hotel room and do this exam while the rest of us were just goofing off doing whatever before just on game day. So there's all these sacrifices and stuff that no one sees. I think people see the, oh, it's great. You get to play varsity athletics and look at you running out in front of a crowd and all that stuff. But there's a lot of sacrifice for those who can still do it in the classroom and do it on the field or on the ice at the same time. Right?
Did you ever make it to George Street, though?
Oh, did I make it to George Street? I have a wing of George Street named after me now, Cassie.
It's
called McClellan Corner. Well, no, I call it that. But you know what? It should officially be that. But let's just say I put a few bucks down there, put a few dollars.
I could see it happening in your future.
Maybe that'd be the ultimate honor, wouldn't it? You know,
I think that. Hey, have you ever done a gig on George Street?
Yes, I have. When I first started doing stand up, I did a pub or two there, and I think they were my first independent shows. You know, where I stepped out of the comedy club world and just went and did my own thing. And so, I was kind of came full circle in a way, where I was being a goof without getting paid, and then I got to be a goof and get paid. So it kind of worked out well for me in the end. So
life happens that way sometimes, hey?
It's an odd little circle that we're in, yeah, for sure. So when you're at Guelph, what did you study in school? What did you do?
Well, I kind of mixed around. I think to get into school, I got into agriculture, which was a big thing at the University of Guelph, and then I moved on to get into the arts program, and I took a little bit of nutrition, but I ended up graduating with a degree in sociology, which I don't really know if I use now. I think I use more of my nutrition classes than anything, but I just think to achieve the degree and, yep, you know, to go through those 4 years and manage everything and get that little piece of paper, I think that's important. And nowadays the kids have to take, you know, two or three or whatever degrees to get a job, but I don't really use much of what I'm doing, so. Yeah. But that's okay. I got it.
Hey, exactly. I was a history major. So, I mean, I'm in the same boat, you know, and I became a stand-up comedian. So, I mean, come on. Where does it – I don't know. Speaking in front of people, maybe. I had to present papers from time to time. Maybe that was applicable. I don't know. But I did
it.
I finished, you know. So that's a thing that I did. So when you were young as a kid, let's talk about early Cassie. Was hockey just your only passion and love? Were you involved in anything else? Were there other sports or activities that you were – that kind of you shared your time with?
You know what? I grew up pretty much soccer and hockey were sort of my two big sports that I played, you know, outside of school. And then, you know, you remember growing up going to school, you could play every sport. So I played volleyball and basketball and track and, you know, I did cross country and you could do everything. So that was kind of always my thing, was to play sports. And, you know, I was in the drama class and, you know, grade 8, I was Rizzo in the play Grease. And,
right,
you know, I was always active in school activities and doing things. And, but hockey and soccer were probably my two best sports. And, you know, soccer, I, you know, made it up to pretty much as high as you could go. And then you kind of have to make a choice between soccer and hockey as far as making it to the next level. And, you know, I chose hockey, and then I got to go to the Canada Winter Games in 1991 for hockey. And I think it was announced a year later that we were going to have the Olympics. So, you know, that became my focus. And the year after my first Olympics, I quit soccer for the first time just because I actually broke my hand playing soccer and had to miss a hockey camp. But,
weird,
you know, sports was a big part of my life, big part of my life. And it honestly kept me on the right track at a, you know, especially during my high school years, where I know for a fact I could have gone in a different direction. And, you know, but sports, I always had to show up for practice in the morning or show up after school. And I think it just really kept me out of trouble. And they're so important to me. And, you know, I hope my daughter follows suit. You know, I think, she plays a lot of sports now. She's only 6, but I hope that, you know, she gets involved in team things. I think that's really important.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think something about being a part of a team, and you get to learn about different personalities, their kind of approach to things, and you have to be kind of all-encompassing, except that people go about their business in different ways. And I think being on a team allows you to do that, right? It's how do I fit into this bigger collective, right? Which is what you're going to take, you know, for the rest of your life. You'll need that skill for the rest of your days, for sure.
Yeah, no, it's been a fun ride for sure. And you know, when you work with teammates, and you know, not everyone sort of does things the same way, but you have to figure out a way to respect each other and care about each other. And you know, you're not necessarily all best friends all the time, but you just, again, it's about respect. And you know, I recently just did an event in Saskatoon, and to get me to do anything in July and August and take me away from my family is really tough. And, you know, she called and said, Cass, can you come to this event? And, you know, we're doing this thing for kids sport in Saskatoon. I was like, yep, when do you need me? July? Yep, no problem. And, you just have this bond forever that, you know, whatever they need you to do something or, you know, if you're in trouble and you need someone, your teammates are always going to be there for you, even if you haven't seen each other in, you know, a long time.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. It kind of endures, no doubt about that. So talk about yourself now getting ready to become an Olympian. I mean, that is a different level of commitment, I'm sure, than what you'd gone through previously, I would imagine. I mean, you're going for the biggest prize pretty much. So talk a little bit about that mindset of going, I'm going to do this. I'm going to make the Olympic team, and I want to be wearing that jersey when the Olympics start. What was that process like for you?
You know, I remember my first world championship was 94, and I had been cut twice prior to that as a 16-year-old and as an 18-year-old, and then finally made it as a 20-year-old and, you know, was named assistant captain my second world championship in 97. And, you know, and at that point you kind of realize, okay, the Olympics are in 98 and I'm probably going to get centralized. And I thought I knew how to train. You know, I trained hard every day, and, you know, I'd work out with Geraldine Heaney, who was a veteran in the national program at the time. But I didn't know how to work out. So we centralized in Calgary, and we learned a lot about ourselves, I think, as athletes. And we really became Olympians that year. And, you know, I knew, though, that after those Olympics, I had to push my fitness and, you know, just change my way of thinking in so many different areas. And, you know, and that was part of just being young and being naive and not really knowing what we were getting ourselves into, because it was the first time for women's hockey. And so a lot of things changed that next 4 years. But, I, you know, we lost in 98, that first Olympics. No one in this country remembers that. They don't want to hear about it.
That's right.
You know, our men's team finished fourth and we finished second, and it was a complete disaster.
Right.
But I learned a lot about myself from that loss, and it was devastating. I mean, you didn't want to come home, and you felt like you'd let down the whole country. And, you know, we had a lot of veterans that, you know, that was it. That was their one kick at the can, you know. And so it was tough. And I did some soul searching. There's no question that next 6 months, and figured, you know, started, you know, instead of pointing the finger at somebody else, I started to point it at myself. And I think that just came with experience. You know, my career kind of took off, I think, physically and mentally from that point on.
Yeah, isn't it interesting, too, that, you know, failure, and as painful as it is in the moment, like when you can take the data and information from that and you can, as a result, be better and be stronger. It's a thing. It's a theme that's come up on the podcast time and time again. And I see it a lot in entertainment as well. I mean, there are no, it's not like a straight upward rise, right? There's all these valleys, there's things that come out of the blue and challenges you don't see coming. But if you can take that data and process it and rewire yourself, and you're right, look inward as opposed to blaming everyone else, you come back even better, stronger. And that sounds exactly like what you did.
Well, you ask any person who's won or who succeeded, one of their critical moments in their lives is some time when they were defeated or when they failed, or, you know, because I believe you don't learn a lot about yourself when you're always successful. You know, you just keep kind of doing the same thing and plugging away, and you sometimes forget to kind of take your game, if you will, to the next level. And, you know, I'll fail every day as a mom, and I'll, you know, okay, well, how can I be better at the next day? And, you know, it's just part of life. And I find winning and success sometimes boring, you know. Like, I like the little valleys, and, you know, I like the bottom of the hill, and I like those things and where your mind and your brain, your body can go. And if you can get up from those things, there's no better feeling than being the lowest of the low and being able to thrive and be successful. I think, you know, those moments are just much more important to me than any of the successes.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's a thing, too, that people try to avoid. People try to avoid discomfort for the most part in their lives, or avoid failure. And at the end of the day, that's where the good stuff is, ultimately. You know, it's painful and emotional, and everybody wants to reach their goals every single day. But that's not reality, for one. And number two, the real fertile soil is in the moments when you don't quite make it. And then, as I said, you can kind of reprocess and come back better than ever. But one of the cool things, too, that's come up in a few different chats I've had is this idea of kind of mental awareness. And I really believe I would have been a far better player back in the day if I would have taken advantage of some sports psychology. And mm-hmm. what What was your relationship with sports psychology? Was that something that was a big part of the women's national team? Was that built into kind of your training and what you guys did? What's your relationship like with that?
Well, it kind of went up and down and all around. And, you know, as a hockey player, I think back in the day, you know, you looked at sports psychology like, you know, and breathe in, breathe out. And, you know, as hockey players, the less we thought, the better. You know, we just wanted to put our skates on and go and play. And, you know, my first Olympics, our sports psychologist was Cal Botterill, and he was wonderful. But his daughter ended up making our team. And so it's an awkward relationship when you walk in and you're like, hey, there's Botts' dad. And, you know, he's the guy that you hug, and he's part of the parent group. And so he was wonderful, but I don't think I utilized him as much as I probably should have. And, you know, again, I was young. And then my second Olympics, it started out great. And for whatever reason, the sports psychologist and I just kind of went in different directions. And, you know, you probably don't have enough time on the podcast to hear my side and her side and all the things, but it just didn't work out. And then my last Olympics, we had one of the best guys in Peter Jensen. And I remember going to the first ever Olympic Excellence Series, and there I am. I'm part of the leadership group with like Mark Tewksbury and Tracy Wilson and Brian Stemmel and Susan Ock. And I got to hear him speak to a group of athletes that we were sort of preparing for their first time Olympics. And one of my teammates was there, Colleen Sestorix, and she's a tough, tough Saskatchewan farm girl. And, you know, she's the whole, I don't believe in sports psychologists like we all were. And she looked at me after he spoke and she said, Cass, he's amazing. And I knew right then that I needed to call our coach and say, we need this guy as part of our team. And that's what I did. And he's amazing. And he still works with the girls to this day. And, you know, he's the only sports psychologist that didn't kind of make it, that I worked with, that didn't make it about him. And he understood the power of laughter. And he understood the power of letting someone sit in their own disappointments. And he, you know, he kind of didn't intervene too much, but he also knew when to step up and to step in. And you know, we'd play a game the night before, and we'd be so tired. By the time you get to bed, it's 3 o'clock, and we'd have to be back for a sports psychology meeting at 9. And he would have us laughing by 9:05. And he just had this great way of positivity about him. And, you know, you just wanted to hug him every time you saw him and grab some of that positive attitude. But it was a process for me. I think sports psychology, I never really had a great relationship with a sports psychologist until Peter. And whether that was my fault or however the case may be, and, you know, I definitely have to take some of that blame, and I could have been a bit more serious about it. But once I connected with him, it was like a revelation, you know? It was just like this moment of, oh, my goodness, this is how good I could have been mentally. And that is one regret I have in my career, is just maybe paying a little more attention to that side of my game.
Yeah, I think I was the same way, because I felt like, I don't know, I just want to play. Let's blow the whistle. Let's do this. But you realize quite often you bring so much luggage, you know, like mental luggage yourself to situations. And it's like, this should be way more fun. Like, it could be way more fun if I'm not bringing all this weight with me and all this other mental garbage that you have. And when you're playing well, it's fantastic. But it's those times when, you know, for you as a hockey player, you know, you're squeezing the stick a little. You're going through a goal-scoring drought. You're just not playing. That fine line between performing well and not performing well is it's a small little increment, you know, and quite often it's just between your ears. So,
especially at the elite level, you know, we're all the stars of our club teams, but when you come to the national program side of things, like that little edge, that's, you know, you're going to either make the team or you're not, you know, and we were all so equal, and everyone was such great leaders, and so. You know, that is something I wish I would have kind of taken a little bit more seriously early in my career, and for whatever reason just didn't see a fit for it, or whatever the case may have been.
Yeah, I hear you. It's funny you mentioned laughter too, because I feel like some of the most successful athletes and people in life in general tend to laugh a lot too. Like, I remember watching you know, the Blackhawks just as they were coming into their own, and I remember seeing them on the bench laughing during the heat of, you know, some playoff battle, and I'm like, where do these guys get the nerve to, like, what are they laughing at? But it was this kind of quiet confidence, you know, like focused, but not to the point of exhaustion. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's that fine line of, no, we're dialed in, but this is not end of the world. This is still fun. I think that's probably where people perform their best ultimately, you know?
Well, sports should be fun, you know, and you know, it was great, like, you know, to be captain of the women's team. It was awesome, but I had two great assistants who were completely different extremes, you know. You know, we had Vicky Sadahara, who's fun, and she made people laugh, and she was kind of goofy, and that's the way she prepared, and she was so amazing on the ice. And then, you know, we had Haley Wickenheiser as our other assistant. She was just so serious all the time, and, you know, no one, you couldn't talk to her before games, but that's what made her perform, and so that's what worked for her. And I was kind of somewhere in between, and you know, I think looking back, we just had a great leadership group because we had those different extremes and those different personalities, and we, you know, made sure that we kind of connected to everyone on the team, which was really important.
Yeah, for sure. I think one of the greatest things in sports, Cassie, is when two teams don't necessarily like each other. So I want to get into Canada versus a little team called the United States of America. And what was that like to play in that rivalry? Like, I remember, like, as women's hockey grew in popularity, like, I remember going, like, I have to watch this game today. Like, this is intense. And I mean, like, this is, I'm not even talking Olympic games. Like, this was just like, oh, you're playing the Americans? I must watch this. Like, what was that like to be in as a player? Was there a real genuine dislike, or was this just kind of a, you know, it's just two teams going at it? What's the inside scoop on this thing? Now, give it to us. Come on, be real. Let's
go. You know, it was hatred. It was pure hatred. And we didn't know each other then, you know, like, not a lot of us went to college together like the kids do nowadays, and our teammates in college. And, you know, I didn't know them, and I didn't like them. I didn't like Karen Bye. I didn't like Cammie Granato. I didn't like Tara Mounsey. I didn't like anyone, and they didn't like me. And, you know, it's just, you played each other in such extreme, intense situations. And, you know, I think our program just prepared better than their program did, but they had great players and a lot of talent, and, you know, could have easily beaten us on many different occasions and the overtimes. And, so yeah, it was intense. And I, you know, it's funny. I didn't really get to know Cammie Granato until probably about 2005, 2006. We both played against each other in our club system, and both were injured, and, you know, had a chance to talk in the lobby. But I didn't like her. I respected her, and I looked up to her because she had been there, and she was an amazing person and an amazing role model for U.S. players and Canadian players at that. But I didn't like her. And, you know, I remember their team wasn't allowed to talk to us in competitions. And so I found this out. Well, I went out of my way to talk to them. You know, I'd make it so uncomfortable that, you know, their coach was going to catch them talking to me. And, you know, I just kept putting daggers and throwing, you know, and that's just kind of my personality, was just to kind of cause a little shit, I guess. And, we didn't like each other, but I have so much respect for Cammie and what she's done for the U.S. program. And she gets none of the respect she totally deserves. I mean, what they just accomplished with the boycott, that's Cammie Granato 10 years ago. And, you know, and so I now look back, I love Karen Bye, like what she's done and how strong she was. And, you know, I hated playing against Angela Ruggiero, and now, you know, we work together on a few different projects, and I, you know, I have a lot of respect for her. But it was pure hatred, and you just didn't like each other. You know, you just didn't want to have anything to do with them. And, you know, it's still similar now, but I think they all know each other. So it's different socially, I think. But we had no interest in hanging out with them at all during a competition.
So when you found out the Americans weren't allowed to talk to you, do you mean like during a game or like off ice?
Off ice. Like, we'd be in the Olympic Village in Lake Placid, and I'd go out of my way. They're like, "Hey, how you doing?" And you could see their faces were just like, they didn't know what to do. Their coach was standing right there. I remember at the games in Turin, same thing, same rules applied. And I know I went up to, there were a bunch of them sitting there, and it was kind of awkward. I walked around the corner. It was me and like 15 of them. And I just started chatting with them, and you could just see their faces, how they knew, oh my goodness, we're going to get in so much trouble if someone sees us talking to her. And that was just sort of my little thing that, you know, just to be a little bit of a pest at times. And, you know, that was just a minor thing, but that's sort of what I enjoyed. And I thought it was ridiculous. I thought we're grown women and we can speak to whoever we want to speak to. And, you know, that was probably part of my lack of respect for one of their coaches that they had in their program for quite some time, and I wasn't a fan, and you know, so I just kind of tried to rub it in from time to time.
that's what a good rivalry needs. You need that, you know, the person who's going to antagonize and chat a little bit. That's the beauty of sport. You know, like, it's funny because when we were talking about sports psychology, I think it's really prevalent, as you said, at a high level, but also in those games that are full of emotion. Like when you already are walking in with that luggage of hatred for the opposition, you can lose your focus as a player pretty quickly in those moments. Like, I've had that as a player playing soccer where I want this so bad and I dislike them so much that if you're not in the right state of mind mentally, you can quickly go off the rails. Did that ever happen? Did you ever have
that
moment?
You know, and I think there were many moments within the games where you had to pull a teammate back, you know, or, you know, in Salt Lake City when we had all those penalties called against us. I mean, you know, the bench was pretty positive, but there were times when teammates were just so frustrated and, you know, you had to pull their emotion back. And, you know, Colleen Sasurix was one of the best to me because, you know, she was a great defenseman and she just could not stand the Americans. And, you know, but she always found this way to keep her emotions in check and just sort of not cross the line, but really close to crossing the line. And I think that frustrated them even more. And, but I honestly, like I have so much respect for them and their program and what they've done. And, you know, I've now got to know a bunch of their young players and, you know, and some of their older players. And I laugh at how much we hate each other. And yet they probably, if I knew them, would have been some of my best friends, you know? So, but that was the rivalry, and it was intense, and it was ugly, and it was every final, and it was gold or silver. And in our country, it's gold. And if you get silver, then it's an extreme disappointment. So, you know, that's just the way she goes.
No, I hear you. There was a lot on the line back then. But, yeah, the fact you can sit back right now and laugh about those times where what your mental state was back then, like what you felt emotionally back then, you're like, I'm not that same person anymore. And you now realize you're right, that you probably had more in common with those people than you realized at the time. So you're just crushing it as an athlete, winning medals, winning championships. It's getting boring for you. You're like, you know what? I'm done. All right. And you decide to go into the broadcast side of things. Was that something that was always kind of on your radar, something you always kind of wanted to do? When did you think that was a possibility for you on the other side?
Yeah. You know, I got some opportunities while I was playing. You know, I'd do breakfast television shows and fill in for the host, and, you know, I did some work for TSN doing women's hockey that I wasn't playing in. And, you know, so I kind of dabbled in it and I thought it was kind of fun, and you get to tell stories about other people. And I love to tell stories about other people. I'm not great at telling stories about myself, and I actually feel kind of uncomfortable, but I love digging up stories about NHL players and telling them. And, you know, same with the National Women's Program. And so, yeah, I originally got hired by TSN just to do women's hockey, and so CBC kind of thought, well, she works for TSN, she can't work for CBC. And it was a conversation between Joel Darling at the time and my husband at a hockey function, and my husband was like, no, she can work for CBC, and he was like, oh. And I literally found out in September, and I did a preseason, I guess, audition. And it was in Toronto, and I had no idea what I was doing. I'd never, you know, worked for Hockey Night in Canada before. And, you know, what got me the job, you know, I asked questions and the guys gave me these awesome answers because I asked them to ahead of time. And, but my producer said to me, he goes, you know everyone. He goes, you know the security guy's name. They know you. Like, I walked in that Air Canada Center, and I was like, hey, Jimmy, John. And then I knew all the players, and the coaches would come up, and they would give me a big hug. And my producer, I think, was just shocked, because I think at that time, legitimately, people didn't understand how much the men's and women's programs interacted, you know, and how much I watched hockey and knew hockey and was around hockey. And, you know, my husband was with Hockey Canada, so we knew all these people. And he said to me, he goes, hey, listen, you were probably going to get the job, but you got it because he couldn't believe how many people I knew and knew me. And he was pretty impressed by it. And then I, you know, went through some tumultuous years of learning how to be a broadcaster on the greatest sports show this country has ever produced. And it was live television, and I really didn't know what I was doing. And I knew hockey. I knew the players, and I thank them every day for being so great to me early in my career when I asked them awful, awful questions. And but it was a great. You know, there I was in Hockey Night in Canada, and then I get thrown into color on my second day. And you know, I know I'm a lot better now, but I'm still an athlete trying to be a broadcaster. You know, so there's always, you know, uphill battles. But it's been a fun ride, and I think I'm going in my 12th or 13th season. So. Wow. I can't be that bad, you know?
Exactly. You're doing something
right. They would have kicked me out by now.
You would have found something. There would have been an email, something. You would have been like, oh, okay, this is clearly not working out. But, yeah, it's quite a transition and quite a risk for an athlete to go from that side, the athletic world, to now you're going to be on live television. And people don't realize, like, live TV is a different game. When you're doing commercials, if you've done TV show type stuff where you get multiple cracks at it and you go, all right, let's do it again. Live TV is a different game. Like, it's a different weight of pressure, right?
Yeah, it's an intense 30 seconds of pressure. You know,
that's
like,
right,
you've got to tell your story in 30 seconds, and you've got to say it in a way that is English and makes sense. And, you know, I'm talking to you, and we talk for a minute and a half each, you know, and we continue on. But you got to find a way to tell a great story in 30 seconds. And nothing is written for me. I do all my own stuff. You know, my producers aren't giving me the stories. I dig up all my own stories. And but it's fun. You get to talk hockey. And the way I think about it is, you know, I've screwed up about 100 times probably in this conversation with something I've said, but I just try to be myself. And
right.
And I think what the hardest thing is I was put into a broadcasting role. I wasn't put into a hockey role, like an analyst on a panel or to do color, you know, full time. I was put into a broadcaster. So, like, you have to bridge things. Like, you got to throw it from Ron and then to somebody else and then do this, and they're talking in your ear, and
yeah.
You're just like, what is going on? And, so it was an adjustment, but it was a lot of fun. And, you know, I really felt that I represented women's hockey, right? So the perfectionist in me wanted to do so well to represent our game so well. And but I'm over that pressure now. Like, now I make a mistake and I look and I'm like, some of the greats of the greats make mistakes. Ron makes mistakes. And, you know, Bob McKenzie and Scott Oak and everyone makes mistakes. I mean, we're human. It's live television. But it's definitely been a lot of fun, and it's been a good ride.
Yeah, for sure. How are you for time right now?
About 10 more minutes. Is that all right?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah.
That works great.
Okay.
I mean, I know you got to get to that mac and cheese. I know you're probably just like, how am I not eating this delicious mac and cheese right now? That's probably something.
Yeah, well, I'm eating it. While you ask me a question, I'm shoveling
some
in.
See, that's why you're a professional and you've been there for 12 to 13 years, because you can time while I'm talking. You know how much time you have to put delicious mac and cheese into your body. Like, okay, that's why. See, guys, write that down. Someone take note of that. That's
a
professional.
I just had a bite while you were talking right there.
See, that's a gift. That's a gift. You can't teach that. You can't teach that. That's a gift that you're born with, and no one wants to talk about it. I was funny. I was talking to Eric Francis on the podcast a few episodes back, and what I said to Eric was, Eric, he writes opinion pieces, right, in columns, and he's given his opinion on something, and I said, have you ever blasted a player and then the next day you got to go into the media scrum and they're kind of like, nah, I don't think so. You know, they're like, I read what you wrote and I don't think I really want to chat to you today. For you, I mean, when you grab these players during the intermission, they might be minus five, right? Like, that guy might have the worst period of his life. And
I try not to grab that guy, but yeah, it could happen. Yeah.
And you're like, oh, rough period there, Sydney. You know, like, have you had moments where you're like, all right, this guy's just, he's not giving me what, because, you know, if you get just yes, no answers, you're like, that's a nightmare for you, right? As an interviewer, you know, you need them to elaborate or whatever. Have you had some moments where you're like, oh, okay, that wasn't what I wanted it to be?
You know, it's funny. There's two ones that stand out for me. And you always give a first choice and a second choice. And one time I was doing a game in Detroit, my first choice was Marian Hossa, and my second choice was Johan Franzen. Well, Marian Hossa had to do something with his skate, so they sent me Johan Franzen. And the media guy said, oh, sorry, it's your second choice. Well, he says it right in front of him.
Oh.
So imagine, he's like, oh, great. So he gave me, like, the worst answers. Like, it was brutal. But then he went and he scored a hat trick. So I went into the dressing room after and I said, hey, I apologize for everything that happened, and, you know, thank you so much for the interview. And he goes, no, he's like, I got a hat trick. He goes, next time you're in town, like, make sure you ask me to do an interview. So I was like, oh, okay. because they're so superstitious. But here's something that put my husband in a really uncomfortable situation. So I got asked to do the panel one Saturday night, and it was an Oilers game, and I was kind of ripping into Taylor Hall a little bit, and my husband was working with Hockey Canada at the time, and they were in Arizona, I believe, and they were having Olympic meetings. So Daryl Cates was there, and Kevin Lowe, and, you know, I'm sure all the GMs were there, and, you know, who were involved in the Olympic team. But importantly, Daryl Cates was there, the owner of the Edmonton Oilers, and Kevin Lowe, who was at the time the general manager. And there I am, Hockey Night in Canada. There's his wife up there, and he's so proud. I'm doing the panel, and I just start ripping Taylor Hall. And my husband said he just, like, they're all drinking beer, and he just put his glass down, and he just didn't even know what to say. And I can't say exactly what was said back to him, but because, I you know, it's confidential, and I respect his conversations with those people.
Yep.
But needless to say, it was an uncomfortable situation for him. And so I remember going to see Taylor Hall the next game I did. And that's one thing I have to say that I'm not afraid to do is, you know, I don't get to go on the panel that very often, but if I did have to rip a player, I have no problem showing up that next week in the dressing room and going right up to that guy and just saying, hey, how you doing? And you know, face him. And if he has something to say, and most times they probably haven't even seen it, but if he does have something to say, I'm going to face it. And Taylor and I had a great talk about it. And he said, Cass, like, you know what? You're probably right. You know? And he goes, you watch and you know. And I was like, wow. And I think the players understand who are the guys that are doing that or the girls that are doing that who actually watch compared to the ones that just do it, you know, to get and make a name for themselves or just do it because they feel they have to. And I think that's one thing with Hockey Night that, you know, there's times where we have to say some tough things or we have to ask some tough questions. But I think the guys understand that we've actually watched that whole week, if not, you know, month before. And we put the work in, and I think that's a big difference when you deal with a player one-on-one. But, yeah, those are two incidences for me that were kind of like, okay, this could have been done differently, but it was all good. It worked out in the end.
Yeah, it's an interesting time, I think, for professional athletes as well, where, you know, you have these 24/7s now, and there's cameras in the dressing room, and there's someone in between the benches and social media to worry about. Like, it seems like a time when players – have to be more guarded now than ever, you know, where guys have to worry about. I know one of the players said if they're at a bar somewhere and someone comes up and wants a photograph, quite often they'll say no. Or if they do say yes, it's like, okay, yeah, but you can't have that beer in your hand and I'm not going to have a beer in my hand because you don't know how these photos are going to be portrayed in social media. Like, it's a time now where players have to be so guarded. So I think when you can build trust with players because you've played the game and they know who you are, there's an opportunity for them to let their guard down a little bit. You know what I mean? But it's a difficult time right now, I think, to be an athlete in terms of, you know, your persona and what's out there about you.
Yeah, I mean, that could be your only beer the whole night, and someone will say, well, you had like 8 or 28, you know? And it is. And, you know, that's one thing with Hockey Night, though, is you get a guy one-on-one in the dressing room, and he's going to talk to you. And they know what you're going to say and what you're not going to say. And you know, I think that's changing here. I think, you know, as a lot of us older broadcasters are kind of, you know, not moving on, but just, you know, there's a lot of new faces now, especially with Sportsnet. But if you can get a guy one-on-one, which often we're allowed to do and request, you can get some great stuff. And there's been so many times where guys start talking to me and venting and, you know, their frustration. And they're talking to me as a former player. And then I look and I go, do you want me to say that? Like, do you want me to tell this story? And they're like, no, don't tell the story. And so I'm like, okay, done. You know, and there's so many things and times like that where you don't say anything. And, you know, and sometimes I'll get the trainers, they come up and they're like, hey, can you tell this story? Or, you know, they're just so excited about something they did for a player or you know, a player's trying something new. And I think that is the advantage of the brand Hockey Night in Canada. And I hope that never changes. I hope anyone who ever works on that show understands that there's sort of, yeah, you have some journalistic responsibilities, but you're going to get some great stuff if you're trusted by the athletes. And I haven't met a jerk yet. You know, I think people in hockey are generally really good and really respectful of me. And I've always appreciated my time with the coaches and the staffs and, you know, the Oilers dressing room. You know, I sit back there with Joey Moss at times and Jeff Lang and, you know, even though my husband works for the Flames, and we just talk because we all, you know, through Hockey Canada, we have this relationship. And, you know, I'm in their dressing room long after everybody's gone, and we're just talking and hanging out. And I really cherish those moments, and I'm so proud to be able to have them.
Yeah, it's all about trust. I think you're right. At the end of the day, it's when people trust, you get the authentic person on the other end, right? And that goes for a lot of different avenues of life. Well, Cassie, I know you're a busy person. You got mac and cheese to deliver probably to the community or whatever it is you're doing out there. What are your plans for the rest of this summer? What does it look like for you?
You know, I'm pretty selfish with my time, July and August, so spending time at home with my daughter, and my husband gets a limited time off, so we're heading to Hawaii at some point, and
nice.
We're going to really do some family time, and honestly, it's just about the three of us. You know, from here on in, I have a few events here and there, but I just really try and shut it down as far as travel. I travel so much during the year, and so I'm a stay-at-home mom for the most part, and I enjoy it, and I cherish that time, and so that's what it is for me. Just the odd thing like this that, you know, you kind of can't say no to, and you don't want to say no to, and just family time. So that's it for me.
I hear you. Yeah. I don't know if there's anything more valuable you can give than your time. So, I want to thank you for your time today. It was an awesome conversation. I really appreciate it.
No, good luck with your adventures and all the best. Thanks for having me.
That's how it all started. Like a whisper in your ear, you told them you loved them and ran as fast as you could. It's not to be taken lightly, but then you never were. Your fingers bleeding, your body aches from the thunder in your heart. So you laid on the line, blindfolded and chalk marked, like a good little soldier. You knew just what you were. Can you give up now? Can you turn this around? Can you keep your heart beating? How do you live when you don't know how? So you laid on the line, blindfolded and chalk marked, like a good little soldier, knew just what you were. Get it out fast enough to make